Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are merging the hats with the Wake and Bake Taharka ice cream made here in Baltimore, Maryland. And this guy today, the guests we have local people. We'd love to take them to State Fair for the chicken and waffles or the shrimp and grits or across the street to El Guapo for a quesadilla or maybe to Fadley's downtown for a delicious crab cake, maybe some mac and cheese and the five different kinds of soups that Damien Hahn bragged to me about last week. And you can ship those crab cakes from anywhere in the world. But given the COVID circumstances we have here, Don Moeller, even the guys that are on worldwide TV, that live in the community, that teach right up the road at Morgan State, it's like the old school reach out and touch someone on the Zoom line, correct?
Absolutely. And before we jump to our guest, I also want to thank our friends at Moeller and Gary Realtors, Jeff Moeller, and our good friends at KO Public Affairs, who work hand in hand here at Baltimore Positive. Well, I was kidding our next guest, Dr. Jason Johnson from Morgan State University, professor of politics and journalism and national contributor to the GRIO, that this must feel like the middle of the night to him, because I turn on my TV in the morning at 6 a.m. and there he is with Joe and Mika. So, Jason, welcome to Baltimore Positive.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, I've like, this already feels like a half day because I've been up so early. But, you know, it's funny. It pales in comparison. I was talking to a friend of mine about this morning. It pales in comparison to what an actual week at a convention is like. Like, you don't get any sleep at conventions. Like, you're on air or you're on call all day, and you go to bed late because you're out like finding stories and partying. So, you know, I'm pretty much on schedule for where I was 4 years ago.
Well, let's start, Jason. Let's jump right in, because I know, you know, you work, you know, not only because you have to show up and talk about it in the morning, but you're a junkie like the rest of us. So you were tuned in last night. Let's start talking about the first day of the Democratic convention. And let's start at the end, because that's what everyone's talking about this morning. The most popular woman in the world who hates politics did it again, did she not?
Yeah. Look, I'm always very careful about, you know, saying, oh, black people are such great speakers. It's almost sort of a stereotype on some levels when it comes to politics. But one thing about Michelle Obama's speech last night, the former first lady, is it is amazing to me. She has been in the public eye for 12 years now, right? 12 years. That's a lot of time. And yet she has retained the same sort of detached, normal person feeling towards politics of a lot of my friends who don't do this for a living. Like, she literally just got on stage, and I feel like what we heard, 60% of that, probably sans profanity, sounded like her having a conversation with one of her friends on the phone. God, I hate this stuff. Boy, this is annoying. But you know what? We got to vote. Like, that's what made it sound organic. It didn't sound like performance art. It was really her just saying, like, look, I don't get into this stuff, you know, just because it makes me feel good. We've got real problems going on. And I felt that her sort of critiques of Trump were fantastic. I thought that the language was exceptionally well put together. I mean, I mentioned this morning, you probably saw me, Don, but when she kept saying, you know, Joe Biden knows how to listen and Donald Trump doesn't listen. Like, my married female friends were like, yes, you know, a man who doesn't listen, it drives me nuts. Like that was, she had the language. And then, you know, when she was talking at the end, you know, another Maryland reference, but when she was saying, like, you know, Trump's just not that, I mean, it made me think of Tony Braxton's song, like, he just wasn't man enough for the job. Like, he was just like, I could have heard that in the background. He's not man enough to be president. So she was just fantastic. I was really, really impressed. It was such a natural, organic kind of conversation. It was a good way to end the night.
Well, Jason, you know, boy, you nailed that, because it's funny. A week or two ago, when I saw she had started her podcast on Spotify, mm-hmm. simply called the Michelle Obama Podcast. So right away, I key it up and I go out for my daily walk. And I'm, you know, I'd listen to her. I'm rambling a little bit, and I apologize for that, but it goes to what you were saying. I remember when her book Becoming came out. Now, I like to read books rather than listen to books. My daughter, who happens to be an elementary school principal, calls me and she says, Dad, I know you don't like audiobooks. Do me a favor. get Michelle Obama's book Becoming on audio. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I started, I couldn't stop telling friends, don't read it, get it on audio. I mean, there's something, you know, my blog is called Front Porch. There's something, as you said, so front porch about Michelle Obama. And when she started last night, I turned to my wife and I said, my God, this is simply another episode of her podcast. And Jason, you're the communications expert here. It seems to me that she has that trait, and Nestor's heard me talk about this ad nauseum, that you cannot teach people, particularly elected officials, you either have it or you don't. And that's that piece you alluded to of genuineness. And talk about that from a, as a communications professor.
So, you know, people can have arguments all the time about what is authenticity and what is believable one way or another. And it's challenging, right? Because sometimes who you actually are, people don't believe, right? Like, you know, Senator Harris is who Senator Harris is. There's a lot of people who are just like, they just don't find it believable. I'm a Seattle Seahawks fan. Most people just look at Russell Wilson like, that's not a real guy, right? Like, even though that's actually him, that's how he talks. So it's not just a matter of being yourself. It is being able to retain a kind of language and colloquialisms that regular people can understand and that people find believable coming out of your mouth. Right? Michelle Obama is a 50-something-year-old black woman who is educated, who's been married for 20-something years, who has kids. So if she makes a reference to a man or listening or not liking this, that sounds like a lot of 52-year-old women living in the suburbs who are like, look, I don't really do politics like that. I got a family to take care of. I got a husband. I got my job. I'm a partner at the firm. But for the 27 minutes that I'm paying attention to this, this woman sounds like other people that I know. So that's where authenticity comes into play when it comes to communication. You have to be a believable source, and you have to use the language that people would believe coming from a source like you.
Well, the other part of her is she's been going to bed every night for 30 years as one of the greatest communicators, you know, of our time, right? Like, literally, she has been connected to this communicator long when he was Barry and smoking weed back in college, right? I mean, like 30 years ago. So that changes, I would think, the way she communicates. For me, there's a part of her that sort of emulates it. You know, like when I hear her, I hear him and I see them. And I, you know, I think a lot of their marriage and their life was sort of worn. You know, they came to the Towson Center, for crying out loud, when he was president. I sat 10 rows behind him with their kids, you know, and he was doing that with basketball with her brother who was coaching ball. But there is something about communication. You're a communications professor. I've been in the communication business since I was 15. Don, you were communications famously. Anybody who's a teacher needs to communicate. She just has that part of it right?
But the I think another key thing, and there's an anecdote, I think it's Richard Wolff's book, Renegade, from years ago. There's this great anecdote about the early primaries. And I think it's like, it's David, if I remember this correctly, it was David Plouffe, Obama, and Michelle Obama are in a car together. And Obama had just like lost a primary or something else like that to Hillary. And there's the story sort of goes that they had this kind of argument in the car. And she was like, if you guys aren't serious about like actually winning this thing, I'll just go home. I'd actually rather be home with our kids doing my job at the hospital and being a mom than flying around the country and doing this stuff. Like I'm not doing this so that we can make a symbolic run and then lose. And that story has always resonated with me from that book because it shows that even in the midst of something that most normal people would be completely caught up in the midst of a presidential campaign where your husband can be president, Michelle Obama's attitude was still like, are we going to do this? Because if we're not, I can go home. I'm fine with that.
You know, and that reminds me, Jay. Yeah, boy, you really are touching all, you're hitting all the notes, because I'm also reminded when you tell that story of the story that the President Obama tells on himself about that iconic moment that none of us will ever forget, where he breaks into Amazing Grace at the funeral in South Carolina. And
I was there.
You were at the – wow. Then I want you – we're going to ask you to
– Clem Pinckney was one of my oldest friends, the pastor of AME. So that was – I was there personally.
Well, I want you to talk about that in a moment then. That's, we never go in a straight line here, but we can't let that pass. So, but there's this moment, and it goes back to what you're saying about the First Lady, where it's Valerie Jarrett and Michelle Obama, and the president says, you know, I think I might lead the church in Amazing Grace. And Michelle goes, I wouldn't do that. And he sort of like, what do you mean you wouldn't do that? I think it'll mean something. And at the end, Valerie Jarrett's sort of on the fence, and she goes, I'm torn. And he said, well, I'll just get a feel of the church. But this honest, there's just no baloney in their relationship. Yes. I guess that's a very unacademic term, right? There's no baloney. But
head of communications, Don Moeller.
Head of communications for Palmer County at one time. No baloney. County executive says no baloney. But jump back, Jason, because that's a moment when you say you were in that church and one of your oldest friends was there. Because I think it takes us all the way up to today. Talk about your feelings as just a human being, an African American male, losing a friend in that church that day.
So I'll never forget that night. It was like Wednesday or Thursday. And I was watching The Equalizer, Denzel movie on Cinemax. And like the movie finishes, I turned to CNN at the time, and they talked about the shooting at AME. I was like, yo, that's Clem's church. I was like, you know, I guess I'll like call him and Jennifer in the morning, see what happened. And so, you know, then the next morning I find out he was dead. And so I had met Clem years earlier, right after I graduated from college. I was his campaign manager. So that's how we met. And there's a story, you guys can find it. It's the Clem Pinckney I knew, and I wrote it for MSNBC. I wrote it for NBC at the time, just about sort of our experiences together and a lot of old pictures and stuff of us hanging out. And it was surreal. I tell people it's the difference between hearing about 9/11 and like knowing somebody who was in one of the towers, you know, because that experience was, somebody I knew, we were friends, we were cool, we would, you know, talk, blah, blah. And so when I was at the funeral, it was a weird role to be in because I was there as a legitimate personal mourner, but I was also there as press to cover it. And so when Obama spoke, I cried. And it wasn't just because the president was speaking. I tend to be too cynical to be moved by politicians usually just speaking. But it was because I think even the president, there's a different kind of pain that you experience as a president when you see your citizens die in tragic ways, right? It's that line from the Joker in Dark Knight, like, you know, nobody has a problem if a busload full of soldiers dies because that's what's expected, right? But one little senator, one little mayor, and everybody loses their minds, and that's what it was like. Like you could see on Obama, just like with Trayvon Martin, it's like, man, this isn't what I signed up for. Like this is the stuff that's really sad. So I really picked up that empathy. It was a really hard day. And when we talk about sort of communications and national conversations, I will tell you there was a collective effort on the part of many African-Americans, because a lot of us know each other who are blessed to do this kind of work in media. There was almost a collective effort behind the scenes to make sure that every time we went on the air talking about this, that we kept the narrative on the fact that this was an act of terrorism by a racist. Because you had Lindsey Graham and several other Republicans at the time trying to shift the narrative and say, oh, this was an attack on Christians, this was an attack on government. Dylann Roof didn't care that they were Christian. Dylann Roof hated black people. Dylann Roof wanted to kill some black people.
Right.
And that's what we wanted to make sure. So yeah, it was such an odd sort of juxtaposition. Every time I went back to South Carolina, I was there last year, I run into Gilda Cobb Hunter, some of the activists there, and we still talk about it. But it's hard. It's hard. I mean, it's weird, but I'm almost like a Forrest Gump on so many of the Black Lives Matter events that have happened. I lived in Cleveland. I know the park where Tamir Rice was killed. I walked through the same 7-Eleven through the neighborhood where Trayvon Martin was killed. Look, I'm a kid who grew up in the suburbs in Virginia. I cut through people's backyards all the time. You know, the idea that I could have gotten shot for cutting across somebody's yard has always sort of been a sobering experience for me. So yeah, that was a pretty heavy moment. It was pretty right. difficult.
We are with, if you're just joining us, we are with Dr. Jason Johnson, Morgan State University communications professor, national political contributor to the GRIO, frequent guest on Morning Joe and other MSNBC programs throughout the day. Jason, let's jump back, and I know there's so much to talk about. But let's go back to the first night of the convention again. Because I want you to react to some text that I got last night.
Okay.
I got some text from some of my progressive friends in the first hour who said, I'm getting a little nervous that, and you, I can tell by your giggling, you know where yeah. I'm going to go. I'm getting a yep. little nervous that the first hour is so focused on the police and Black Lives Matter and the protest. I'm all in, but I'm afraid we're going to turn off middle America in those swing states. And I got more than one of them, and I'm thinking, boy, it's not hitting me that way.
Right.
I was touched by the national anthem and all the diversity in the national.
One of the problems, Don, how it's hitting you. We're on the team. Well, I already know who I'm yeah. voting for, right?
That's like, what I want to ask Jason. Should those folks be concerned about middle America and the first hour of that convention, or is that just noise, Jason?
No, it shouldn't be concerned at all. Oh, my God. Look, let me tell you, as a political scientist, so my doctorate is in political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the school that just had to close because they didn't know how to manage COVID.
But they kept the money, by the way. Just, I want to point that out. Yeah. They did keep the tuition
they
money.
Did, yes, they are. They didn't keep the tuition money. And my area of expertise is actually campaign management. That's what I wrote my doctorate in, the difference between what political science tells you to do and how campaigns actually run. And the funny thing is, and this is right in line with that first hour, okay? First off, most elections are about turnout. They're not really about persuasion anymore, right? The persuasion is not Republican versus Democrat. The persuasion is, do I vote or not? Because most people already know who they're going to vote for. So people who get concerned about, oh, is it going to turn people off? It's like, not really. Most people have already decided, especially because you have an incumbent. But the second thing is, and this can't be overlooked, is that there's also no such thing as undecided voters. It's the biggest load of crap that you ever see on television. I always say, you guys know what, Baron Munchausen syndrome? You guys know what that is? So that's the psychological disease where, like, a parent will make their child sick in order to get attention, right? So they'll make their child sick or something else. It's this weird psychological thing. It's like, oh, they pretend they have a problem so that people will love them, people pay attention to them. Undecided voters are like political Baron Munchausen syndrome. Oh my gosh, I don't know who to decide between Donald Trump and blah, blah, blah. And they just say that stuff so that Chris Cuomo will fly them up to CNN so they can be in a town hall and stay in a nice Omni hotel. Okay, they know who they're gonna vote for. You can tell by listening to them. So nobody watching the Democratic convention last night had their mind changed. Nobody who wasn't watching the Democratic convention last night had their mind changed. If the idea of people protesting against cops who you pay for with your tax money, murdering somebody in broad daylight, if that's something that you are on the fence about, you weren't voting for Joe Biden anyway, right? So what people have to understand is that these Democratic conventions, just like the Republican convention next week, they're just pep rallies. They're not forums. They're not discussion sections. They're pep rallies. So if you weren't feeling the message right last night, then the message wasn't really for you. And I've never believed anyone who says otherwise. There's not one person in America, as great as Michelle Obama's speech was, like, there's not one person in America who is deciding between Trump and Biden yesterday and Michelle put them over. There's not one progressive in America who decided last night, because Bernie Sanders spoke, that they're actually going to vote for Joe Biden. They made that decision 2 or 3 months ago what they were going to do.
Well, let's talk about the actual game, because I'm with you. I've talked about sports for 30 years here. There's what we do, talking about it all week and having right. everybody else talk about it and who's going to tackle who, and then you go play. Right. The field is tilted when I start to see lock boxes on mailboxes, and mailboxes are the delivery system for said ballots. We have spent a whole week here talking about how to get ballots, how to register. You're in Maryland. I'm in Maryland. You're at Morgan State. Don's in Catonsville. I'm in the city. They're all coming from different places in different ways. And I think there's just a lot of confusion about it. And, you know, I go back to Trump's real MO, which is chaos, right? Like sowing the seeds of chaos throughout the electorate on both sides, how it benefits him and scheming it. And the fact that really Congress is a little bit powerless in a lot of ways while, you know, Mitch is out on the farm with his people. So the idea that we're rah-rah-rahing and shish-boom-bah, really this is about, can I get a ballot? And if I fill it out legitimately, Trump or Biden or Kanye, for crying out loud, will it count? And is this on the up and up? And who's counting the votes? And I think that's on the front burner for both of these conventions, I would think.
Yeah, well, on the front burner in a different way, right? So the Democrats talked a little bit last night about voter protection. Trump next week is going to have people who babble about, you know, fake ballots and everything else like that. I have a piece coming out in the Griot today where I did an interview with D. Michael Bennett, who was actually supposed to be on the Board of Governors. He was appointed by Obama to be on the Board of Governors, but ended up being blocked by somebody who was revealed later on in the story from getting on. And he talked a lot about what we're going to have to do with the mail. His argument is that our best bet is going to have to be local officials. It's local officials who can expand absentee voting. It's local officials who can decide, like they do in D.C. and Colorado and Nevada, to send everybody an absentee ballot. So just getting the ballot is going to be dependent on your local officials. Now, what actually happens on election night? And I can tell people this. If you can, register now, get your ballot now, and do one of two things. Either get it now and send it in, or get it now and assume that probably closer to election day, you might be able to drop it off at election center. Because I think what a lot of states are going to do, because look, you've got Republicans, not these national ones who only care about keeping a dictator in power, but you got local Republicans, county commissioners, state senators, governors, and everything else like that, who are like, look, man, like, I get that you're trying to get rid of post offices in Democratic areas, but there's still post offices and it can still gum up the works. And wouldn't you hate to be a Republican county commissioner who ends up losing a race 105-98 because so many other people from your home county didn't get the vote, right?
Like, yeah, I mean, I really thought, like, if there's anything left that's bipartisan, I mean, we can't even get bipartisan on, like, climate or water or, you know, why trees are catching on fire, just different things. Right. I thought, like, the right to vote and the fact that whether I'm red or blue, I would want to be able to vote and know that my vote would count. And I always say this to the handful of Republican friends I have left that I still have some respect for. I say, you know, he's not just lying to me because I'm wearing a blue hat or a purple hat, or he's lying to you too. You know what I mean? He's lying to everyone. He's repressing your right to vote and your grandmother's right to vote as well. So that's really the weird part, that I think that the other 38-42%, depending on what day you wake up, doesn't sort of comprehend that part of it. And they're not outraged as they should be.
Well, they're not outraged for a couple of reasons. One, because, and you can see it, whether it's voting, whether it's COVID, whether it's the environment, whether it's mass shootings, you have about 35-38% of this country who believes it ain't ever gonna happen to them. So they don't care, right? They think these things happen to other people. They think mass shootings happen in other neighborhoods. They think that the environment destroying beaches and making it difficult to water your lawn is something that happens on the West Coast. They think that all of these things are going to hurt other people.
I used to think that masks only happened like in Asia and the Far East. You're like, that was never gonna come here, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. So that's their attitude. So they think the same thing about voting. But I think the other important thing to remember, and this is, again, why you have some local Republicans are like, hey, man, we can't really do this, is that you know, Trump's core base, and this is not unique to Trump. Trump is the result of us seeing this, really, you can go all the way back to kind of Newt Gingrich in 94 and everything else like that. They do not simply disagree with Democrats anymore. They don't just disagree with what they consider to be liberal ideologies. They don't think they're legitimate. They do not think that a Democratic government is a legitimate government because it was voted into power by people who they think are fundamentally second-class citizens. You were voted into power by gay people, Black people, Latinos, Asians, and college kids, all of whom we don't really think should be able to have an active role in how this country works. So it's not surprising that you have government, that you have Republicans who are sitting on their hands, because to them, they still think, oh, well, you know what? If you're keeping Black folk from voting, they shouldn't really count anyway. If you're keeping college kids from voting, they shouldn't really count anyway, unless they're on the field running football for me. So that's why people aren't up in arms. But again, I always say this, you know, you say this in sports, you know, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. The only reason Trump is doing this stuff is because he knows he can't win. Like he can't win unless he does this. And they are hoping that they're sophisticated enough for this mail shutdown to work. But I'm telling you, it's only going to result, and I'm sure we can talk about it later.
Well, the Ukraine thing worked, right? I mean, the Russian thing worked. I mean, everything that's happened, golfing 400 times in four, you know, all of this has worked so far. It's so far so good in sort of getting away with it, right? I mean, having people staying in his hotel, cutting money deals with the Saudis, on the phone, on the plane with North Korea, Russia, you know,
Ukraine.
All of it's worked, right? I mean, in the same way that we're seeing what's going on in Belarus, so far so good for him, right? It's worked out. He's still sitting in the chair, even though the people are in the streets going nuts, right?
You know, Jason, back, yeah. I mean, and that's the authoritarian piece right there, too, right? Authoritarians put it right out in the open. I mean, they don't try to hide it. They don't try to hide their light under a bushel, so to speak, to be biblical. They bring it right out in front. Here's what I'm doing. And the other side's going to complain about it. That's because you hate them. I hate them. We all hate everybody. I mean, that's the game. I mean, Jason, when you look back, you mentioned a few minutes ago about turnout. And I've been looking at some of the results, and they're mind-blowing. Let's just take Michigan in 2016, a state that people talk about famously, that Donald Trump won by 11,000 votes because people in Milwaukee did not vote, ostensibly. That's what people point to, Milwaukee. Go back 4 years. What makes that particularly, and you're the political scientist, what makes that political malpractice, campaign malpractice, is Barack Obama won Michigan by 450,000 votes. Democrats hemorrhaged almost 500,000 votes in 2016.
So there's a couple things, and first off, it starts with what I call the Rick, Ron, and Scotts, right? Rick Scott, Scott Walker, Ron Snyder, whatever it is. You had a lot of Republican governors who were doing everything they could to wipe. I mean, there were 170,000 people wiped off voter rolls in Milwaukee, right? 170,000 people. You also had, it was the first presidential election after the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. So you didn't just have an enthusiasm gap. You had shenanigans, the level at which, if they were happening on a foreign country, we would be sending you UN inspectors. That was the kind of thing that people were facing in Michigan and facing in North Carolina and were facing in Georgia in 2018. So that played a big role. The other part that happened in 2016, and I'm not a Russia skeptic, but I always tell people, if you tell me to name the top five reasons why Hillary Clinton lost, Russia might be fourth. Their most direct impact was WikiLeaks. You know, the stuff they did as far as the hacking was less important than WikiLeaks, which too many people in the media were completely complicit in promoting because they weren't paying any attention. But the thing about it is that you had a lot of people in 2016 who assumed that Hillary Clinton was going to win. She never managed to convince anybody that she was running 5 points behind. And that's what you got to do when you're running for president. You've got to always have people think, we're going to lose, we're going to lose, we're going to lose. And they weren't. They weren't acting like they were going to lose. They were pretty confident they were going to win this thing. So people stayed home. They assumed it was a fait accompli. They decided to pout and vote for a third-party candidate. And then you wake up the next day, between that cheating and other things, Donald Trump ends up being the president. I don't think that's going to happen this time. I think you've got so many unhappy white folks, and I say this all the time, this is going to be the election where white folks are livid. You see some of these early turnout numbers, you see some of these the requests for absentee ballots. The one thing you can't do in America is piss off large numbers of white people. And that's what Donald Trump has done. That 171,000 people who are dead, they've got families. They've got friends. They've got coworkers. My brother lost an employee 2 weeks ago to COVID. This guy's worked for him for 10 years, died of COVID. And so
meanwhile, I had a guy on my Facebook that, you know, is a peripheral friend of mine. Mm-hmm. Literally this morning, I woke up to it's a hoax. Like literally, and I'm thinking to myself, I can't believe, I used to respect you, right? Like there are still people. I mean, this is a 60-year-old guy who's been politically active, who's, you know, worked in banks, he figured out the world, thinks legitimately if he came in and sat and had coffee with me, would convince me that this is a hoax. Like I throw my hands up and say, I'm shocked that I still know people that believe this.
This is what's kind of nutty to me about that. Because look, I am as much a conspiracy theorist as the next person. I'll go down all sorts of strange YouTube corners that probably have me tracked by the federal government at this point.
You've been to Roswell?
Yeah, I have not been there yet. But it's kind of on the list. But here's the thing. Like what I expected when COVID, you know, when COVID really started to take over, is I expected people to say that they think it's man-made. Like, that's usually the conspiracy. This was created by the government and George Soros and Israel. You know, that racist, anti-Semitic, crazy nonsense that you hear out there? That's what I expected to hear. It has been weird, Nestor, because I've heard this too. It's been weird to hear people say they think it's a hoax. I'm like, how can you say that these people randomly dying? That's like the people who said that the Parkland shooting was fake or something like that. And I have an old neighbor from high school who was making that same argument. He's like, well,
the hardest part for me in the social space is that when you share this for your world, whoever your world is, how many other people see that and either agree or like me say, dude, I just can't associate with you anymore. I mean, right. This is too important. I've been wearing a mask for 8 months. Your friend's father died. I've got a dozen people who've lost family. I lost a friend of mine that I went to high school with a couple months. So at this point, I just think to myself, where is that circle? And then OANN, whoever the hell they are, asking the president the questions that he gives them. And then they're, you know, all Alex Jones is yelling at kids in parks last week. I see this
guys, we cannot believe it. And again, I want to come back to that, push back a little bit on who these folks are. And if you're just joining us, we're pleased to have Dr. Jason Johnson, professor of communications, political science at Morgan State University, contributor, national political contributor to the Griot, and frequent guest on Morning Joe and other MSNBC shows throughout the day. Guys, we can continue. They make me crazy. They make my head explode, too. But then I look back recently at an election, and Jason, I need you to talk me off the ledge, where a QAnon conspiracy advocate is now going to Congress. So that's not a couple of whack jobs in the basement. She's going to be in Congress.
I think she went to Roswell, I'm pretty sure.
What the hell is going on, Jason? What is that? What's that about?
Because you have a lot of people in this country who believe things that don't make any sense, but it's convenient for them. And look, that's always been the case, right? You can go back to birthers. You can go back to people who thought that AIDS was created at Fort Detrick, Maryland. You can go back to people who believe, I mean, there's all sorts of crazy shenanigans that people will believe. And look, my attitude has always been, you can elect whoever you want. Like, Steve King is a racist. Okay, whatever. If that's what his district wants, that's what the House of Representatives is for. You can pick whatever kind of crazy, nutty person that you want. See how effective they're going to be when they get into Congress with their tinfoil hats, right? What concerns me is that when you have people who do know better, who pander to that nonsense in order to, you know, achieve political power. They don't even believe half of this crap. They don't believe that there's a crazed pedophile ring going on at a pizza joint in Washington, D.C., but they will pander to those kinds of people because they think, aha, that's how I'm going to get into power. And here's the other part about it. And I've always thought that this was always gets me about that kind of conspiracy belief. It's never the conspiracies that actually make sense. It never is. And I remember having this discussion with like birthers, right? If you go back to birthers, like, you know, 8 years ago, whatever it is, when Barack Obama was going for office, I remember having a debate on a radio show with this guy who was a birther, blah, blah, blah. And I said, if you told me that Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States, and the fact that he's been able to get this nomination and get this far is a reflection of the fact that all of our elections are a complete sham, and that the Illuminati and New World Order just picks the president, I would listen to that. I can hear that out. What I don't believe is that Barack Obama was born in another country and managed to fool Hillary Clinton during the primary, the FBI, and the entire Republican Party, but you and Scooby and the rest of your friends in the back of a van figured this out? That's the part I don't believe. Like, no.
Well, and then last week, you know, once they figure out how to pronounce Kamala, right. That, I mean, she wasn't anointed. Was it 2 hours? How long did it take for them to come up with that?
Right. Oh, my gosh. It was so lazy. Look, the things about Harris, this is the thing. Harris has a pretty darn clean record. The only thing that you can complain about with her is, okay, she had an affair with Willie Brown like 30 years ago. Okay, Willie Brown is almost 70 years old. And I think he has a 5-year-old, right? So like he and his wife have been separated since 1978. They've never officially divorced. Like, that's just how Willie Brown is. He's the he's the mayor of San Francisco and former
Most powerful person in California politics for decades.
Yeah, I mean, he's basically the Clyburn of California, right?
Right.
So, like, that's the only thing you've got. Now, if you have problems with her criminal justice record, then you can go through that discussion. I think there's some real things there. But what's been fascinating is, and this is something I wrote about in my first book based on my dissertation, where I talk about what's the most effective strategy when you're attacking people. And one of the problems that Republicans are having, and one of the reasons that they always had problems and Trump was afraid of Harris and he was afraid of Biden, is because it's very difficult to brand people who already have a stable brand, right? You can't turn Joe Biden into someone else. He's been Uncle Joe for 8 zillion years. He was Barack Obama's sidekick. He was the Paul Newman to Barack Obama's Tom Cruise. That's all you got. You can't turn him into a swamp creature. You can't turn him into the Burisma Biden, right? Those things don't work. And you got the same thing going on with Senator Harris. You may think she's kind of like the second Aunt Viv. I mean, she's not, you know, as down as maybe Michelle Obama comes across, but you can't say she's not competent, and you can't call her a radical, and no one in their right mind believes that this woman wasn't born in the United States.
Right.
So they're just going to throw things at her in the hopes that they can knock her off her game, and that's not going to work because she's on her game.
Well, Jason, before we let you run, you've been very gracious. You probably have 10 more interviews to do today.
I'm going
one
to sleep.
One of the things that always...
I thought you were teaching the children in Morgan. I thought that's what we're doing here.
One of the things that we always hear about, a lot of people are writing about it, is that there's a significant difference. We all know that the African-American vote is the backbone of the Democratic Party. Has been, always will be. But folks will say, but there's not a monolithic African-American vote, and there's a difference between older African-American voters and younger African-American voters. And last week on the air, when Senator Harris was announced, you actually pulled out your cell phone. And
yes,
you began to read some text messages from students who were weighing in right away. And I found that interesting. So really, it's a two-part question. Talk about the reaction of your students to the selection of Senator Harris, and then talk about this perceived difference between younger and older African-American voters.
So a lot of my students are pretty ambivalent about Harris. And I always think this is important because I don't think people recognize. First and foremost, I had one of my friends is sort of prominent activist in the city, and she's like, well, I'm excited about Harris, and these kids don't vote. And I was like, okay, the kids who text back their political science professor are the ones who vote, right?
I'm talking
to my students who actually vote, right?
Right.
I was like, a lot of them aren't enthusiastic about Harris. They weren't enthusiastic with her about her during the primary because they don't have the sense of identification with her that maybe a 35, 45, 55, 60-something-year-old Black woman may have, right? But they're like, hey, we got to get rid of Trump. But they're universally not enthusiastic about her. I know a lot of people like that. And I've said on more than one occasion that in my personal life, my friends who don't do politics and don't do media, I don't know anybody who was a Harris supporter in a primary. None. Most of them, they weren't really fans of hers. But that's fundamentally different than whether or not you're going to go out and vote. And I think the thing that people have to understand about African-American voters is you got your four groups now, right? You got your older folks, you got Gen X like me, you got your millennials, and then you have your Gen Zs. Your Gen Zs are very much excited about this kind of election because of George Floyd and everything else like that. Like, we got to get rid of this person. Now, they may be too frustrated to vote, right? They may not be able to figure out the process, but they care, right? They're seeing this. Millennials and Gen X like myself, that's really the squishy area because we're the generation that's like, we don't know if it matters, right? That's the generation that's like, okay, we elected Black officials, we elected Black people, this, that, and the other position, and yet the men who killed Freddie Gray still got off, right? We worked so hard and we got Barack Obama in office, and then 53% of white women just threw Trump in, and now he's ruining everything. So it's Generation X and millennials who need to be convinced and motivated that their vote is actually going to matter because they've only seen substantive changes to the negative. Older voters, look, they're going to vote regardless. And while a lot of them may not be happy with Harris for lots of reasons, some may not like her personally, they may not like who she's married to, they may think she's too California, they may not like AKAs, who knows? At the end of the day, they're going to vote. And I've always thought that people are, anybody who's decided that they're not going to vote for Joe Biden because they don't like Senator Harris, well, you weren't going to vote anyway. Right? And that's just like the person going back to the very beginning. That's like the person is like, you know, I was going to vote for Joe Biden, but then I saw George Floyd's relatives, and that was just too much for me. You weren't going to vote anyway. I don't believe you. You're just trying to get on a radio show. So these politicians need to concentrate, and campaigns need to concentrate on the people who are actually going to turn out to vote. Because if you can't find motivation with 171,000 people dying, you're not going to get motivated by an additional text from the Biden campaign.
Jason, you've been a great guest. We really appreciate the time. Fantastic. We hope you visit back and circle back from Morgan State. Oh, yeah. We'll all get together, get a crab cake and a beer when this is over with, hopefully, huh?
Most definitely. I am always open to crab cake suggestions. I am still learning Baltimore. I go to, what is it? Was it Coco's?
Okay. Oh yeah. So you come with me. We'll stay six and a half feet apart. And I've been here my whole life. We'll it's Baltimore positive. I'm positively going to show you around. All right.
Awesome. We'll take you down to Fadley's, and we'll introduce you to the Fadley's crab cake, and you will think you're in a little bit of heaven.
Listen, I'll need him to run my campaign when the time comes, Don.
We'll keep looking for you on MSNBC and reading you on the Griot. Thanks so much, and tell everybody at Morgan we said hello.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
We appreciate you. The good Dr. Jason Johnson joining us here, Professor of School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan State and MSNBC. On behalf of all of our sponsors, including Mueller and Gary Realty, you can find them on the internet, buying, closing, selling, doing the deals out there, MuellerandGary.com. Our friends at Taharka Brothers Ice Cream, shipping that Wake and Bake, shipping the Honey Graham, even the Key Lime Pie that's sitting in the freezer for my wife. They're doing that as well. And Fadley's Crab Cakes all over the world. You know where they are. You know how to get them. One click away, they deliver them to you. I had a few delivered to me the other day. I showed up on the internet. I am Nestor. He is former Baltimore County Executive Don Mueller. Together, we are WNST.net, AM 1570, calm, local, and Baltimore positive.